Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Dr. Redmond.
And we are here for three episodes closing in on the end of Season 7. The last competent season of Criminal Minds? Is that a fair descriptor? Because I'm thinking about all the... Because there's been a ton of very stupid episodes this season. But as we proved last week, there were still episodes that could say true things, even while the show was being stupid. That the show was able to restrain its worst instincts to say things that were legitimately true. And I think that is an ability it loses badly going forward.
Okay.
We're going to talk about that as we go. Let's just say I've grown cynical about Criminal Minds since I finished reviewing every single episode of the show currently extant this past week. What could have happened at the end of season 14 that might have turned me against the show even more? I wonder.
You now understand why I said I never want to watch this show again.
Well, we're going to.
Oh, yes.
But,
oh, yes.
Yeah. And this is one of those things where... and we're going to talk about it more when we get to that season. But it is worth saying that it's like, it is weird to do something that the fans want you to do when it ruins all of your characters. Mm-hmm. And just because the fans want it doesn't make it a good idea.
Yeah.
And that is all I'll say about that. We'll talk, it'll come up more later. Actually, it's going to come up more... two episodes from now when we're talking about the 2-hour season finale of this season. But, it's
even before that.
Maybe.
It's offensive
is my point.
Thing. Yeah. Well, I watched this show, right?
Of course.
Okay. And as we started discussing a few things, now that you've finished the whole thing, yeah. And you're bringing things up, and I'm going, and you're going, well, that was in season 13. I'm going, okay, well, that shows you how much attention.
It was bad when I was trying to explain to you stuff about season 14. You're like, I have literally no idea what episode you're talking about.
It's like, well, what are you talking about? Oh, I thought you were talking about... No. Oh, no, okay.
Entirely different season.
What has happened is that I have not put any of this in any way, shape, or form into my long-term memory or whatever.
You have emotionally checked out from about... Well, we know exactly when. From the moment they fired Thomas Gibson. You emotionally checked out of the show.
Yeah.
And when we get to those episodes, you are going to pay attention so we can talk about them in depth. But there's a reason you didn't pay it. Like, I'm only paying attention to the episodes because I'm reviewing all of them.
Yeah. It's a very bizarre thing to have discovered that I actually didn't. And I guess whatever I might have put into long-term memory.
Yeah.
I probably took out, unconsciously took out, particularly after that
god awful season ender. I would understand how you could end up doing that. It's funny. And I mean, if you had asked me, well, who's the most important member of the show? I would have told you Aaron, mm-hmm. I would have said Aaron is the most important member of the show, obviously, but I was not prepared for the degree to which he really 100% anchored the show.
Yeah.
He really did. And without him, they are just spinning off into the aether.
Yeah. And I wonder how, like, we're sort of looking at some of it, but part of me is just going, but I don't even understand how he friggin' anchored the show, because
it's still a badly written show.
Yeah, it's still a badly written show, but not only... Well, yeah, but it's more badly written.
Now.
I mean, when you start looking at the things that we say about it now, like, it's just getting to the point where sometimes I'm watching these episodes and I just want to friggin' check out. Like, this week is, there are going to be a couple of things here that I'm just going...
Oh, come on.
And it changes. Yeah. Oh, come on. Oh, give me a break here, guys. So there's something, so I'm not sure how
he anchored the show. Exactly. Like, what was it about his presence that keeps stuff, you know, more grounded, more believable? Like, and I mean, and a lot of it comes down to, as we always say, gravitas.
Yeah. And I think that that's because that was one of the funny things when I was, I mean, I mentioned to you about all of their partner things that they have now on the web that came to me. Right.
Yeah.
And, it's funny watching the comments, you know, and the comments are, oh, isn't it nice to see Hotch smiling because he never smiles on the show? Well, that's not true because we got a whole bunch of episodes right now where he's smiling on the show, you know. So,
but
generally speaking, it's the gravitas issue, and it's as if the show needed some like anchoring, and they replaced him with someone who couldn't anchor the show.
No. And I mean, we might like Padgett Brewster. I mean, we do like Padgett Brewster. Yeah. She was great on Community. The Andy Richter Controls the Universe show, one of my favorite sitcoms of all time, and she's fantastic on it. Like, I love her as a performer.
Yeah.
She is not capable of grounding the show the way that it needs it.
Yeah, and it's very, very strange that after... Yeah. Because the writing... But it's not just that, like, because the writing gets substantially worse after he leaves.
Yeah.
So,
and you kind of wonder, it's like, I know he directed a bunch of episodes. Was he like forcing people to rein in their lazier instincts as writers? Like,
yeah.
How much was he doing behind the scenes? It's very strange. But anyway, we're going to talk about the show's complete decompensation after the the departure of Thomas Gibson when that happens in the show. For now, we actually have episodes.
Oh, yes. Okay. That's right. It hasn't happened yet.
No. Season 7. We have four more seasons of this guy.
Yes. But it does remind you constantly of the fact that he's gone.
Yes, it does.
Now that you've gone to the end of it.
Now that we've gotten to the end, yeah, and that's the thing. It's like, now that we're at the end, we're like, God, you really do notice it. Like, you really feel his departure when you're as far into the show as I am. Which is, again, completely caught up. All right, so, episode 715.
Okay, is it 715?
I believe it's 716. No, 716.
I'm going, bad. No,
that's 15. My bad. 716. Go.
There are things that I could say about 715.
Go.
Too.
We did that podcast. 16.
Yeah, I know, but these are new things. Never mind. A family affair. When two Atlanta, Georgia prostitutes are found stabbed to death, the BAU suspects the crimes were committed by a killing team. Meanwhile, Hotch prepares for the FBI triathlon and JJ plans a girl's. No. She doesn't plan the girls' night out.
No. Garcia plans a girls' night out.
I know.
And she has to get a babysitter to be able to go to it. Because Will is out of town. And she forgot about it. Yeah, she forgot about it. So that's right. As always, we pay more attention than the people who write the synopsises.
Yeah. Anyway.
All right. Okay. It's the William Lewis episode. I had no memory these were all so close together.
This is the William Russ episode.
Yeah.
And as usual, and who's the woman who plays his wife?
Kathy Baker from Picket Fences.
That's right. Kathy Baker. They do a wonderful job.
Well, no, the two of them are fantastic. And the interesting thing is that, like, obviously the casting was a very canny choice to show sensitive TV parents, because you and I aren't aware of this, because we will always be giant fans of William Russ because of his performance as Roger on the TV show Wise Guy, one of the best performances I've ever seen in the best show I've ever seen. So he will always be Roger from Wise Guy to us. But to people younger than me, he was the dad on a show called Boy Meets World that was an incredibly popular, long-running family sitcom.
Oh, really?
So his appearance... I did, exactly, right? I found out very late.
I've never heard of it.
Exactly. In the same way that you and I hear Kurtwood Smith, and all we will ever think is, oh, Clarence Boddicker from RoboCop. That is all we will ever think when we hear that. Yeah. But for people younger than me, he is and only ever will be the dad from That 70s Show.
Ah.
See? And in the same way, so in a sense, casting him in this part as the murderous father, well, the covering up father,
yeah,
who's trying to make up for his evil son, right? Yeah. That was a specific comment to the, like, the people watching. Hey, remember the dad from Boy Meets World? Like, that is how it read to the audiences watching this episode for this first time. Oh, hey, remember the dad from Boy Meets World? Look, he's killing people now.
No, he's not killing
people.
Well,
no, you know what I'm saying. He's helping out. He's, again, trying to be a good father, but now in a much darker context.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it played completely differently for people younger than me who watched this episode.
Yeah, and that's why they would have cast him in that role.
Yeah, and so both he and... Oh, no, that's 100% why he was cast.
Why he was cast. Yeah.
And so both he and Kathy Baker were... were people who were famous for being, you know, caring parents on sitcoms. So it was supposed to be a little nod to that. It would be like casting Carol Brady as the parent of a crazy murderer. It's basically that equivalent is what the director of this episode was going for. Or maybe the producers. I don't know who was in charge of the casting for this episode, obviously. Yeah. But yeah, it was specifically supposed to be a callback to that role of his care, that role in his career. So
and
yeah, that's a little
an
behind
extra
the scenes
spin
trivia
on that one.
Yeah. A little behind the scenes trivia for you. So yes, it's, ugh.
What a god awful episode.
It really is.
Those parents, how in God's name did they ever think?
Yeah. Well, the mother's crazy.
Yeah. The mother is completely crazy.
He's completely insane. She has been shattered, and the father is so so racked by guilt over how his drunk driving has turned his son into a paraplegic that he will do anything the
and
wife
murderer
says. And murderer, right? Yeah. And murderer, that he will now do anything the wife says. So yeah, it's a rough episode all around.
Oh God, it's just a horrible episode.
Yeah, and then it bothers me because this is something you're going to see in the show a lot, which is it's going to come up later. But what really frustrated me was they murder a sex therapist.
Yeah.
And they find the body, and then the cast doesn't immediately go. They act like we still have to figure out who this killer is. No, you don't. The sex therapist 100% wrote down who she was going to meet. People know.
She's not a prostitute. She's not a high-end prostitute. Yeah. What she's doing is legal and covered in some
by
states.
By their insurance. Exactly. Like, they could have done this in the insurance. They specifically mentioned that in the episode. No, she's not doing anything shady. Oh, well, like, she didn't have any online records. So go to her office. So ask her partners in her therapeutic practice. Yeah. They're like, she didn't have computerized records, so Garcia can't hack them. So walk over to her office and look at her frigging address, her date book. Like, no, we've got to pursue this lead about the psychology of the... No, you don't! Someone phoned her to make an appointment. She agreed to that appointment, she went to the appointment, and she got murdered. Unless you're assuming that coincidentally a sex therapist got clonked over the head and dragged off the street and attacked, this is 100% an immediately solvable crime. And they don't do that, and it pissed me off so much.
Yeah, I know. That was one of the stupidest elements of this show. I'm going, no, you can't. You can't even, and that was the thing, you can't even hire a high-end prostitute because she's usually got,
But anyone you hired to do an out call, there's a record of where she went.
Yeah.
Anyone. Like, whether that was a high-end sex worker or whether it's a sex therapist, right?
There's a
record.
Somewhere.
There is 100% a concrete record. And with the sex worker, it's going to be a little harder to find that record. With the surrogate, it's not going to be hard to find the record at all because she works with a service. Yeah. You know, she's working with a medical practice.
I was going to say she's working in a legitimate business, but I don't think that my impression from the whole thing was that somehow or another, they thought that what she was doing wasn't really legitimate.
It does seem that way.
And that meant that they had blinders on their eyes and didn't go. That would be how I would explain that, is that they didn't think that what she did was legitimate. So consequently,
they didn't look at it seriously.
Yeah. They didn't look at it as a serious business.
Jesus. I mean, I don't think you're wrong, but that is a rough thing to say about the people who make this show.
Well, no, but it would fit in with the everything else that we see when I talk about sort of they play lip service.
Yeah, pay lip service.
I swear to God, so many times they play lip service to the racists.
Pay lip service.
They play lip service to anyway.
I agree with you.
Morality. It's the morality issue, you know.
Yeah,
it's
that we're always talking about.
Yeah.
You know, and it really is. It's the morality issue of they have this warped idea of morality.
I shouldn't even. Sometimes I'm going, well, maybe it's just, maybe I shouldn't say it's the morality issue. What I should say is that they pretend to be understanding, and they pretend to understand what the psychology of all of this is.
Yeah, but there is this underlying really puritanical judgment.
Streak in there. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think you're going to have a hard time making that argument persuasively.
No. No,
I
it's
mean,
just...
But you're right, because this is a perfect example of them treating a character who's just doing a therapy job.
Yeah.
And treating her like she's no different
than a sex worker,
the sex workers they're picking up on the street. I'm like, well, no, she is different. You have to get training in this. You have to do, like, this isn't something you just start doing.
Yeah.
Like, you have to work at getting credentials to do this job.
Yep.
And she works. She probably has therapists, like psychiatrists, psychologists, and the like, who she is on call with.
Yeah.
Who she might work out of their office. You know, and even if she doesn't, she understands the dangers of the job she's doing. Mm-hmm. And the idea that she would ever go anywhere, ever, without people knowing exactly where she was is just ludicrous.
Yeah, no, as I said, they're treating, like, the whole thing that, like, I can't even imagine how they got her to come.
Well, you'd think his frigging physical therapist would have known that that had happened.
Well, like, you know, like they can't, you can't, I mean, and if, yeah, I mean, it's like they didn't look, okay, here's what it is. They didn't look into what a sex therapist does.
Yeah.
You know, they dressed her up properly, you know, like a professional and the rest of it, but it's like, she was a high-end prostitute role-playing a sex therapist.
Yeah, and the crazy part is...
That was the way they treated her
the character.
Because there's no way when I, you know, when I'm further thinking about this, that they could have hired a sex therapist just... You can't phone them up in the phone book.
No, unless it's, they come. You get a referral from his real therapist.
Yeah.
You know, just his doctor, right? His real therapist, his doctor. They would meet. They would have a conversation about what they expected out of the therapy and what they planned to do. She's not coming over and trying to have sex with a guy that she's meeting for the first time. That's not what these people do. It's actual therapy. That is what sex workers are for. That's not what surrogates and therapists are for. Yeah. And that is the field we're talking about.
Right. And,
the crazy part is, there's
home.
No reason. What bothers me is, there's no reason that this character couldn't have been a call girl.
Yeah.
Who does out calls. Yeah. They went out of their way to make it so she was a sex therapist only to make the episode make less sense.
Yeah. Well,
because by
yeah.
making her a sex therapist, the whole plot of the episode makes far less sense, and they should have caught them immediately. More importantly, the characters should have known they were going to get caught immediately.
Well, maybe not the family, but
the sex therapist. Well, of course the family would have known. You called someone and told her to come to your house to get murdered.
Yeah.
Any person would know there's a good chance someone's going to find out about that.
Well, maybe subconsciously William Russ did it because he wanted to get caught,
maybe.
But, I mean, because all along he hasn't liked this and
he's thought it was terrible, obviously. Yeah,
so.
But yeah, and it's just so frustrating to me because, like, it seems like they're doing this weird drive-by insulting the sex workers. First off, they're always kind of insulting sex workers. That's just what the show does. And I have my own problems with that. But no, they're going out of their way to lump in, you know, licensed sex therapists with all of the other sex workers who get murdered on their show. And that just seems crazy to me.
That just seems criminal.
For the love of God, they refer to it. I could be wrong here. But it's like, I swear to God, she doesn't have any online records. I might be remembering this wrong because I'm so angry about this. But yeah. I swear they actually said she must have a, like, black book of clients.
Yeah.
Again, talking about this woman like she's a call girl or a sex worker.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I swear that's in there. And if I'm wrong, I will accept. But no, okay, you remember it too.
I remember. Yeah, she has a book. I don't know if they called it a black book, but they called.
She'll
have a book with the names and stuff of her clients in it.
It's like
maybe
the idea that this, you know, you're right.
But somehow or another, it's massively shameful to have this business, and therefore nobody would want to know they were seeing a sexual therapist, and therefore she keeps her clients secret.
Which is crazy because, as we see in the episode, while most of them don't, some of her clients just report to bill the insurance for this.
Yeah.
So it's like she runs a completely legitimate business that there's nothing wrong with being in. But this show treats her with the same disdain they treat all of the other sex workers who have appeared on the show. So yeah, kind of a rough episode overall. And then we get another hilarious looped in late episode justification, which is, so they're literally on the way to, they're literally on the way to go and arrest the killer.
Yeah.
And then a bunch of them detour to check out a car accident. And it's like, and so they throw in a looped line where it's like, oh, we got a call that the father had been in a car accident.
Yeah, I know.
So we rush down here. Who cares? If he's dead in a car accident, he's no threat to the woman you're going to rescue, is he? Can't you sort that all out later?
Well, yes. So there's somebody in the editing room. Who's trying to fix some of the bad stuff in this episode while they're doing their
But just like in the one last week where we talked about the woman who had been, you know, cut up, who had been brutally cut up, which is a completely different MO than all the other victims, but they showed up at the crime scene anyway, and then the editor was like, oh, BTW, the scene doesn't make sense, and they run and they do a line to fix it. But it's like, fundamentally, the people writing these episodes, like, are either writing it so quickly or putting in so little effort that they're not noticing that huge plot stuff makes zero sense.
Mm-hmm.
And when the editor has to fix that later on, that shouldn't be the editor's job. The editor's job is crafting the best possible version of the show. The editor's job should not be making sure your episode, you know, makes a bare minimum of sense. Yes, has a base level coherence.
Coherency.
That should not be your editor's job. I do not envy the editor on this show. All right, so let's move on to episode 717.
Okay, let's move on to I Love You, Tommy Brown.
Yeah.
Okay, when Three Seattle, Washington couples are shot execution style. The BAU suspects the crimes were committed by a female killer with a maternal instinct. Meanwhile, Garcia grows anxious after overhearing a conversation between Kevin and Morgan. No, she doesn't overhear the conversation. No, that's what she's anxious
about. She just sees that they were talking. Yeah. All right, so here's the thing. Literally, last time, I don't know if we were talking right after the show, or we came up during the show. We talked about how terrible Garcia is to Kevin, and it's honestly good that Kevin found happiness with another woman, because Garcia is terrible. And this is a perfect example of Garcia being terrible.
Yeah.
She is the worst. There is no, I mean, seriously, just marry that man.
Yes,
you're
but
not
nobody...
going to find anyone better for you than Kevin.
Yeah.
And honestly, after, and I hate to like talk about relationships this way, but after she sabotaged his career to keep him around, to then say, no, I don't want to commit to you. I just want to keep you around. Jesus Christ, Garcia, you are terrible. And no one ever calls her on it.
Well, why would they? Nobody ever says maybe you should get therapy for that.
Nobody ever says anybody should get therapy for anything.
Yeah. Well, except for Prentice.
Except for Prentice, yes.
After she got killed by Doyle, she gets to go to
therapy. She does get to go to therapy, you're right.
Yeah.
No, but it's like the subplot in this episode about Garcia, because I was trying to remember how she and Kevin break up. Because I know they're fully broken up for good by the time we find out about Joe dating Strauss, which is maybe like at the beginning of midway through season 8, because Strauss gets killed at the end of season 8. So can't be that far into season 8.
No.
I don't remember exactly when that happened, but I wasn't remembering exactly when that happened. But watching this, I'm like, I forgot they broke up this early and how terrible Garcia is. And the fact that, as you say, like, no one says boo.
Yeah.
Like, Jesus Christ, Derek. Like,
give her a decent advice, you know,
for
just
a change.
Yeah.
You know?
Just because she asked you, just because, no, he wants to keep, because
he wants to keep her obsessed with him.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's this sick relationship.
Yeah. It's a sick, sick relationship. Rather than supporting her, Kevin, or saying, well, you know, maybe, you know, it wouldn't be such a bad idea if you kind of, you know, told him, okay, so you've got issues, so talk to him about it or whatever.
Well,
oh, no.
The thing is, what I love is, do you know what I love about this episode? Is how much Kevin is, like, trying to, he's like, I'm not asking for your permission to, what do you call it? I just want some advice on how to propose. It's like, well, no, but what Kevin's really, no, he's not asking for Derek's permission. What he's doing, he's trying to say, Derek, can you let your sick thing with Garcia get out of the way? I want to make an honest woman out of her. And we find out is that, no, Derek can't get his sick thing with Garcia out of the way.
No.
Because he's not supportive of Kevin, and he doesn't tell Garcia the hard truth.
Yeah.
That maybe what they're doing isn't 100% emotionally healthy, and maybe she does have to try having a real relationship once in her life.
Yep.
And it's like, it's this weird thing where how much do the writers understand that that's what Kevin was doing?
They don't.
Okay, it's like...
No, they don't. They think it was a cutesy little thing that he sees Derek as sort of like the quasi-father figure.
Yeah, okay.
Right?
It's, I swear to
and,
God.
And then if he's a father figure, then that is a really
sick. It's even sicker than we've been saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. I don't think the writers understood what they were writing. I don't think they ever do.
Yeah.
But I'm being really, really harsh, but I'm getting more...
Well, no, but you have to be harsh, not just because Nicholas Brendon, who we love, has lost a job out of it, but because it's so bad for the characters.
And I'm wondering if he does...
bad yes. for Garcia.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, you know, and what makes it even worse is you've finally seen the final episode, and you're going, yeah, they can't let anybody, eh?
No. No, oh god. Well, again, in 2 weeks we're going to be talking a lot about season 14's ender, cuz that's the season ender of this episode is 100% about Will. So there you go. It's the only episode he gets for the rest of the show. Seriously, it's his last focus episode. Will's in like 15 episodes, but there were only ever 3 that involved him in a case, and it's season 7 is the last one. But again, we're going to be talking about that in 2 weeks. And our disappointment with the writing staff at Criminal Minds.
Will one more time rear its ugly head.
One more time. They got 10 more episodes. But anyway, so what's so frustrating about this is it's like, you feel like this is Garcia's moment. To say, you know...
I'll give it a try.
To be like, I'm a 32-year-old woman who's never had a serious relationship. Right? And I've got this guy who is in many ways perfect for me who wants to try a serious relationship.
Yeah.
And between my sick work wife stuff with Morgan and my own emotional trauma about the death of my parents, I have trouble connecting with people, and I'm too scared to try to have a real relationship with Kevin.
Yeah.
And that's what's going on here?
Yeah.
And the character doesn't face it. And in fact, chooses to do the wrong thing, and the show, like, accepts that. Just accepts that blithely.
No, like, supports it.
No,
supports
you're right. It doesn't even accept it. You're right. I'm being too nice.
No. You're being nice. No, it accepts it. It makes it seem like somehow or another Morgan's behavior in this is perfectly fine.
I know, which is insane.
Which is insane. I mean, it's, well, I guess because the fans, well, if Morgan had, oh, now here's a cutie.
Please.
Here's a cutie. Okay, now we know that he went off to do his own show.
Yep.
Right? And I think it is on CBS, right?
I think SWAT is on CBS.
Yeah. But I really wonder whether or not, because the fans always, I'm sure, just as much as blah crap, the end season ender to 4, the fans probably always wanted Garcia and Morgan to get together in the end, right?
Which is crazy.
Just bear with me.
Okay.
And Shamar Moore probably had some sense that this was a stupid thing to do.
Yeah. So he just left the show.
And so he got out of the show before, you know.
Before it got too bad. Yeah.
You know, because he was never going to grow up as long as he stayed with, as he had this bizarre relationship with, you know. And the funny thing is, the show sort of says, you know, I mean, that's always what gets you, which is why you ask the question, do you think they knew what they were writing? Is because they do have Kevin say.
Yeah.
Right? That he doesn't understand this relationship they've got.
Yeah. I mean, he doesn't say it's toxic, but that's what he's feeling.
And Morgan is so uncomfortable about it. Right?
Because he knows he's stringing her along.
Yeah.
There's a whole song about it. By the Mamas and the Papas. I saw her again last night.
Yeah.
I was just saying, it's like, and what it comes down to is it's like, he likes that he gets all of this romantic approval without having to do anything.
Yeah.
He loves that. That's what he loves about his relationship with Garcia. And they try to make it nicer and like their family many times.
Well, then they're a friggin' sick family because no brother and sister
would
talk
ever
like that
behave
to
this
another.
Way. Exactly. Yeah. No, but that's what I'm saying. The show tries to play it off and say they're just, you know, They're just family. They love each other. No, that's not what their relationship is. Their relationship is her flirting with this guy who's never going to reciprocate her feelings, and him flirting back because it gives him power.
Yeah.
That's what their relationship is.
Yeah.
And Kevin coming to him, it should have been his wake-up call to look at the stuff he's done in his life.
Or at least to look at what he's doing to Garcia.
Yes. Well, no. I mean, it should have been a wake-up call for his entire persona overall, but he's had a bunch of those. But you're right. It should be for his relationship with Garcia. This should be his wake-up call. But it isn't.
To let Garcia go.
To let her go. And he can't do it.
I think that this would be a wonderful relationship. You know, you really have to.
Why doesn't he encourage her?
Yeah.
And his line, he needs it.
Well, what about your Tuesday nights?
He needs her. He needs this unconditional support from her.
Yeah.
He needs it so badly that he's willing to to enable her bad life decisions to keep this sick relationship going.
Well, so, yes. Toxic. Not only toxic masculinity, well, it's just, but just toxic relationship stuff.
No, no, it is. It is a completely toxic relationship. And yeah. We've always talked about how they have this completely toxic relationship, and this is its apotheosis.
Yeah.
And you exactly. People can point to, what about the terrible moment, right? What about that terrible scene where they are forced to do counseling because people have complained about the completely inappropriate way they behave with each other?
Yeah.
Right? And then the show's take is, it's fine. You can't judge us. That's the show's take.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, no. I agree.
And it's like some people would point to that and say, well, that is the most, clearly sick part of their relationship. And people who might say that would have forgotten, no, she lost a chance to be in a relationship with a man who was perfect for her because of their sick thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and this is the episode. This is the bottom.
And of course, that episode was done before, quote unquote, Me Too started.
I know, right?
It's an interesting thing.
Because right? It's actively anti, workplace behavior standards. I'm going to be interested to watch that episode next year in season 9, whenever it was. Because, in the post-Me Too era, we're frigging the guy who was running CBS, where this episode aired, was taken down by Me Too. It's going to be interesting to watch the message of that episode in that light. Because it's an anti-Me Too episode before Me Too was a thing.
Yeah.
Hey, maybe we should talk about the plot of the actual episode rather than the 3 minutes we spend with Garcia and Kevin this week, huh?
Yeah, well... here's what I would say is that for all of its flaws, right, you just see this, massively toxic relationship.
Yeah, no, it's by far the most compelling thing about the episode.
Yeah, William Russ is very good in this episode.
Yeah.
Kathy Baker is excellent in this episode. Everybody is.
No, we've moved on to the next episode.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's fine. Last...
Tommy Brown. Okay, yes, we... I don't... That's why we're talking about Garcia. Because
it's a trash episode.
It's a trash episode.
And do you know what's interesting to me about what a trash episode it is?
Yeah.
And you tell me your thoughts on this. It's interesting because it's like... The criminal minds, they could have just done a story about an abducted child.
Yeah.
And the race to find the abducted child. But there is this... Grand Guignol, this obsession with gore, this obsession with brutality and tragedy that said, no, in addition to the abducted child, we need 7 people to be brutally murdered.
Yeah.
And not only does the plot not need that, the plot doesn't allow for that to have happened because fundamentally there's no believable way this woman could have found out what people fostered her baby.
Yeah. Like, how did she find them?
How? And the thing is, the only way you can say is, well, maybe she broke into the records of the place. But if she had done that, the records would have said the baby was with them for 2 days and moved on.
Yeah. So why would she
wouldn't have bothered going? And that's the thing. It's like, this whole episode, not one part of the murders makes a lick of sense. And the murders break the logic of the episode's world. And the murders are only there so that there could be brutal murders. Mm-hmm. And the most absurd thing is, she goes to see the last foster parent, and somehow the last foster parent has the name and address of the woman who's adopting the baby?
No.
How would she?
No, fast foster parents like that.
You're literally there to look after a kid for a couple of days until they find a stable place to go.
Yeah.
That's all you're for. You don't know where they've been. You don't know where they're going. Yet we're expected to believe that this woman found out the first fast foster couple and then, like, used them to find the next couple, and used the next couple to find the third couple, and used the third couple to find this woman? No! That's not how any of this works!
I know.
And it's only there so there can be upsetting murder scenes and a girl finding her parents' dead bodies, because the show traffics in this kind of brutality. You know, and it's like, it's brutality that doesn't make sense within the world of the show. That's the craziest part. Like, there's no reason for these additional murders. You can do an episode about a kidnapped baby, right?
Yeah.
And try to figure out who stole the baby. Where's the baby gone? Blah, blah, blah. Okay, well, where is she? Oh, she goes and she tracks down the father of the baby. And it's like, it can all be a race against time. These extra 7 murders add nothing to the show. And they're just there because this show wants, they want the brutality.
And as I would say, the sisterhood is one more time not happy.
Who is
it
this time?
Kimberly Ann Harrison.
God damn it, Kimberly Ann Harrison. Honestly, like, there might be something in our question of whether the women at that writing table are feeling, you know, not intentional, but are feeling culture, writing room culture pressure to pitch and write the more unpleasant episodes.
Yeah.
To prove they belong.
Yep.
I mean, given that, like,
which tells you that there is no respect for women.
Yes.
In the writing room of this show or at CBS.
Probably. Well, no, and it's interesting because you look at this, because I was going to say, the crazy idea that the two, the two episodes I find the most loathsome and despicable in the history of this show, because of how much they are in love with their killers and how much they adore demonstrating the torture, the brutal torture and rape and murder of these women, were both written by the same woman, and it's the same woman who wrote the lynching episode. Crazy, right? There's something going on in this writer's room that all of these women are writing the most loathsome episodes. And it was true back when Erica Messer had her writing partner to, you know, rein in her worst urges.
Yeah.
And then when Deborah Fisher?
Yeah, Deborah Fisher.
Yeah, Deborah Fisher to rein in her worst impulses. And it only got worse for Erica Messer once she started writing on her own and running the show.
Yeah.
Anyway, this episode, the plot is complete trash. So,
The
plot makes
trash.
No sense.
I mean, the only thing I can say, at least they gave the kid a reason to finally start to understand what had happened to him.
That's nice. Yeah.
Because you know, that's the only positive thing I can say about this episode is that when she says, "I love you, Johnny Lewis," right?
He actually comes to the conclusion. Oh, right. She is just sick.
Yeah. And that, what she did to
she
me.
She is a predator.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was just her latest victim. It wasn't a romance for the ages. It wasn't, you know. It wasn't, age isn't anything but a number. Right? It wasn't, you know. I know. Ugh. Right. It wasn't like this. Oh, well, we're kindred spirits and we just happen to meet each other and blah, blah, blah. When we're such weird ages and like, no, there's none of this. All this justification is just that. It's justification. She's just a predator.
Yeah.
And you're right that it takes him having that. It's sad that it takes him having to have that happen for him to realize it. But
well, he's a kid.
He's a kid.
He was, what, 13, 14 years old, you know?
Yeah, he was 14 years old when this happened to him. You know? That's 14!
Yeah,
that's
well,
insane!
That woman who got out of prison, well, they've turned that case, right? That one case.
Oh, yeah, no, this is Mary Kay Letourneau. This is an adaptation of the Mary Kay Letourneau story.
Yeah, and they did get married afterwards and had more kids.
I know, it's really upsetting.
But, you know, I guess your first love, what can I say? I just...
Yeah.
Never mind.
And Billy Falau, yeah. No, I still remember that story, that really depressing story, that they moved to, like, Indonesia, where no one, you know, no one would be able to judge them. He's got family there, and no one there cares about, you know, the scandal of the, hopefully no one there, for their purposes, cares about the scandal of their relationship, so, you know. Yeah.
Well, by then he's older, right?
So yeah, by then he's old enough, so.
It's not
scandalous anymore, except that he's got a wife 20 years older than he is.
Yeah, well, yes, but so does the president of France.
Yeah. I was about to say that!
You know, let's talk about the president of France, right?
Yeah, who also married his teacher, so there you go.
There you go, right?
This is a thing that really happens, people.
Yeah.
It's not just in fiction.
Yeah. Not just in fiction, and it is a most peculiar situation.
Yeah,
that one.
And then, by the way, the most troubling line in there for me was, well, you know, if it had been a man molesting his teenage girl student, he'd have been in jail for 20 years, and this wouldn't have happened. I'm like, what fantasy world are you living in?
Yeah,
that a teacher goes to jail for 20 years. For a first offense of molesting a 14-year-old girl.
Yeah. No.
That's insane that he thinks that that's true. But then again,
whoever wrote the show thinks that that's
true. Yeah, well, no, you're right.
Maybe.
She thinks that that's true. Well, you know what? No one on that writing staff corrected her.
No, that's right. Yeah.
So it's not like it's just Kimberly Ann Harrison who is to blame this for that line.
Yeah.
Like, there's plenty of people who signed off on that script, and Joe Mantegna had to say the line. So it's like, I can't, because these people are the ones who, and the fundamentally at the end of the day, have to say the line. Even if they don't care at all, they're still responsible for when they say garbage like that.
Yes. However.
Yeah.
However, as we well know that Thomas Gibson was complaining about a line.
That's true. When he got into that fired. Fight that got him fired off the show, he was complaining about a stupid line, too. So uh-huh. There you go. Yeah, it's...
My character
it's a rough episode.
Yeah.
But you're right. The one positive thing that this episode has to offer mm-hmm. is that it exists to say that, no, it's still molestation and it's still awful, even when it's a boy being molested by a woman.
Yeah. Like, as I said... It only gets itself redeemed at
literally the last moment of the show.
Yeah. I wouldn't even call it a big redemption.
It's no, it's not, of... but it does have a clear message.
Yeah.
It does have a clear message that this is that society treats them differently.
Yeah.
That society treats them differently because of rape culture.
Yeah.
You know, because of toxic masculinity, because of rape culture, because men can't admit that they have been abused.
Yeah.
And they have to justify anything that happened to them as they were the instigator.
Yeah.
Because men can't admit that they were sexually abused, because society teaches them never to admit that they're victims. It is it is a factor of toxic masculinity. And this episode, in that last moment, and only in that last moment, comes out hard against that.
Yeah.
So for everything else we've complained about this episode, the needless brutality, all the horrible stuff with Garcia, like the tragically horrible, ruining her life stuff with Garcia, through all of that, it does come out with a very strong and correct message that no, just because they're the
He's
woman
a boy.
is older here, and just because it's a teenage boy who was psyched to have sex with whoever he could, that doesn't make it okay, and it doesn't make it less serious.
Yep.
And so that is a good thing. We can say that about the episode. It isn't...
yeah, we can say that about the episode.
It isn't an abject failure.
No.
All right. So yeah, let's move on to our next episode, shall we?
Foundation. When a Flagstaff, Arizona boy goes missing the same night a Latino teenager is found wandering the desert, the BAU suspects a local woman's repressed memories may hold the key to the kidnapper's identity.
Yeah.
Morgan uses his troubled past to forge a connection with the survivor.
Kind of? It's weird that it's more the story of, like, World War II pilots that...
Yes.
...that gets it done, and that's not really his trouble. It's not his confessions about his own molestation that really get the job done. It's...
No.
...this nonsense about challenge coins that gets the job done. Challenge coins. But yes, still, there's a moment in the episode where I'm like, Jesus Christ, you people. Derek, what are you doing? It's like, someone says, have you tried communicating with him in Spanish? He's like, he's not talking. What does it matter what language I do with him? Are you insane? Of course it matters what language you do it in. If this is first language, he's going to be more comfortable speaking in it. The fact that he's not comfortable speaking means you should make him as comfortable as possible. What is wrong with you?
Oh, he's still feeling guilty about what he did to Garcia last week.
Oh, damn.
So he's thinking straight. How's that?
There you go. But it's like, it's such, but every now and then you just hear a line and you are baffled.
What?
Baffled that that line made it into somebody's mouth and that the actor said it.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it can just be that Derek doesn't speak Spanish. It's fine.
Yeah.
And he was trying to talk to the kid and now bring in somebody who speaks Spanish. There you go. Like, but for him to say he doesn't see the value in trying to communicate with this Hispanic kid in his own language, that's kooky. That's just kooky. They jump to the idea that the guy is specifically targeting specific kids way too quickly, and it's based on nothing.
Well,
no, it's weird because
weird. Like, I don't know why they think. Well,
we should focus on low risk victims. He must be targeting specific kids. Why? The last kid seems to be a high risk victim. The one you know about, the only victim you know about, is a high risk kid who is the family of migrant farm workers.
Yeah.
Right? And then the next kid is a kid who literally was just grabbed off of his bike in the middle of the road at night. Like, that really does sound like a crime of opportunity.
Yeah.
He's everything about this
somebody.
Yeah, he's looking for any victim. Oh, there's a kid at the side of the road. I'll bump his bike with my car and then throw him in the trunk. And that's what he did. So the idea that they have this whole narrative where he must have, like, focused on the kids who come by the construction site to watch him, and he was obsessed with those kids, and then he stalked one. And I'm like, yeah, but if that were
the case, how
unbelievably lucky would he have to be that the same night his previous victim got away from him, in an amazing coincidence, this specific kid he was obsessed targeting happened to be out biking on his own in the dark.
Yeah.
That would be incredibly lucky. That would be lucky to a degree that makes zero sense.
The Criminal Minds does incredibly lucky a lot.
That's true. No, but it's weird that, like, why would you even think that he was looking after... I don't understand why the characters think he would be looking after specific people. There's just nothing about his... what they know about him as a killer that suggests that. But yet, that is the first thing they jump to. And I think the show wants us to assume they're right about it.
Yeah, well, yeah, but it never really comes up again.
It never comes up, but I still think they want us to assume they're right in the same way that every single time the characters do a profile, right? Every single time the characters do a profile, they will, based on zero evidence, announce what age they think the killer is, and they are always right.
Yeah.
Once in, you know, a great long while, they will be wrong about somebody's age. But by and large, whenever they say a character's age, it'll turn out they were right about the age of the killer.
Well, that's and to prove that profiling works. It's to prove works. How smart
they are. Except the thing is, they never have any basis for what that age is. Ever.
As gets pointed out periodically.
Every now and then, they will, well, whenever they think it's a 30-year-old, but it turns out to be a 50-year-old, they'll say, well, yeah, figuring out the age is the most difficult part.
And or he was in hiatus and he hasn't actually matured at all, so therefore, really, he's a 30-year-old in his mind, even if he's not in his factual age. How's
well,
that?
Honestly, in season 14, they'll be like, the killer ends up being 24 years old. And they're like, how could he be this young? Well, he studied at the feet of his father, who's a serial killer. So he already had a fully developed, MO. And I'm like, yeah, but he saw his father do a very limited amount of the stuff. And there's fundamental differences between what he did and what you're doing. So no, he wouldn't have an already fully developed MO. You know? And sorry, just I saw the sequel to the Eddie Cibrian episode. So yeah, there you go. It was Penelope.
I told you. I mean, here's the real problem, right?
Yeah.
With now that you've seen the whole thing, you can't help but color.
It Wait. Colors some of the stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
But but that's what bothers me is when they talk about it really does bother me when they make that guess about the age of the guy and they're always right. And I'm like, yeah, but your guess is based on nothing. You know, your guess is based on nothing and you're always right. And that's what ticks me off. And the thing is, I would accept it if they just didn't make guesses about age. The guess of the age never really helps them catch anybody. You know? So just don't make, and I refuse to believe that there is a difference in the way a 25-year-old strangles a male sex worker and buries them in the woods and the way a 45-year-old strangles a male sex worker and buries their body in the woods. There's just not. Because here's the thing. What's his name? John Wayne Gacy was killing for 20 years, and there was no meaningful change in his MO over those 20 years. He was just committing the same murder over and over again with new victims. That's all he was ever doing. And because he finally killed someone who had a direct connection to him, they caught him.
Yeah.
But he was committing the same murder over and over again for 20 years. Also probably molesting a bunch of kids in that time who never reported it because it's America and men don't report sexual assault. And so just the whole idea that they want to pretend that they can guess someone's age has always bothered me and to a certain extent will always bother me.
Well, it's, yeah.
It's frustrating because that's just not how this stuff works.
Yeah. Well, and as I said, some of those things... often what happens with me is that there are other things that bother me more, but yes. it's one of those continuing consistent problems in the show. And it's, you know, it's kind of bizarre. It's the magical thinking part of the show.
Oh, absolutely. And it's like, no, we just have these abilities so we can always know X, Y, or Z. I'm like, that's not even how profiling works. It's not only that profiling doesn't help. I've made that point. The show, well, as I say, I've made
Your
that point for years.
Your blog makes that point.
The show has made that show a point for me time and again.
Yes.
Not only does profiling not help, I mean, look at this week. They catch this guy because his daughter shows up and tells them who did it.
Yeah.
It's the only reason this guy gets caught.
Yep.
But anyway, it's funny because it's like when they try to play up what they bring to the case, it's never a compelling argument. It's just not a compelling argument what they bring to the case. And the age is just this microcosm of the problem that exists over and over and over again on the show, of them coming up with these crazy facts based on nothing. But I will say this, I was about to say, when I was rewatching the episode, what was going to bother me was if they said at any point, we don't have enough evidence to get a search warrant for your father's property. Yeah. They never say that though. Because I was all ready to say, oh, so now you start caring about evidence and search warrants? But no, they didn't say it.
Yeah.
At no point. And honestly, like, I don't understand their move with the daughter. I would say, if I had been trying to manipulate the daughter into helping, or trying to get the daughter's help, not even manipulate, that's a mean thing for me to say. If I was trying to get the daughter to help, my move would be, and I didn't understand why it wasn't, have her get the dad out of the house.
Yeah.
You know? Come up with a pretext to, you know, take him out to lunch, to tell him about something in your life, blah, 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 blah. Get him out of off the property for 3 hours so you can go out there and search the place. Yeah. And had they done that, they would have been fine. Also, I'm weirded out as to why they're pretty sure that she's right.
Yeah.
Right? They're pretty sure that she's right, and they're pretty sure that he's got a kid somewhere in that house or somewhere on his property. But they don't follow him at all.
Oh, I thought you were going to. Okay, because we haven't gotten to one of my big
Your
things
big pet
about
peeves
this.
With it.
No, one of my big pet peeves about the show.
Which was
the shtick on repressed memory.
You know, we'll get there in a second.
Okay.
No. The crap about repressed memories they pull. Whoa.
Well, they had right. They felt they had, but this is the second time. I'm not going to. Those who listen to the show all the time will know that I've already had a long
digression.
Screed about repressed memories. I'm not going to do it again. But, you know, particularly since this isn't a repressed memory, nobody is trying to, it is a repressed memory, but nobody's trying to dig it out
the
of
the fact her. That they come, go out of their way to name check an assault on therapists.
When yeah.
This woman hasn't been in therapy. No one told her that her dad murdered kids. She heard about the kid showing up in chains, and then when she saw her dad's picture, she had a memory from her childhood.
She had a post-traumatic flashback.
Yes, that is absolutely what happened.
She had a post-traumatic flashback and then went, oh, because
hell.
All along she's probably, it's
she,
always.
She's known on some
there's
level.
There's something wrong with her father now.
Of course.
Would she have ever gone any further than that? No, because
probably not.
She was a child. Her mother died. But mm-hmm. to equate this one with repressed memory,
yeah,
it's bizarre. Except that we'll go to my stalking horse, which is it's still a stalking horse, which is Scientology just absolutely hates therapists.
Therapists, they do.
So they got
yes. In case you're wondering, this is going to be coming up for a little while. Dr. Redmond has a theory that someone like in charge of the narrative of this show is a Scientologist, and that's why they keep being against therapy on this show.
Well, not just therapy, why there's no ethical content.
Why there's, yes, why there's no ethical core to any of their actions. Why they only have situational ethics that don't even remain consistent from season to season with the various characters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? And that is a good point, and maybe it's Scientology related. But what's crazy in this episode is, and this is the thing, every time recovered memories come up, we're going to do this disclaimer, okay? In the satanic panic, the part that was fake was not that children were being molested. The part that was fake was the cops thinking that there were child molesting satanic cults all over America. Kids were getting molested. So here is a true story about Sigmund Freud. He was doing therapy in Vienna around the turn of the century. I still say the turn of the century, even though, you know, it's the turn of the last century. Yeah. That tells you how old I am. I still call 1899 the turn of the century. But anyway, so the turn of the previous century. So what happens is he keeps coming across these women who were screwed up and traumatic and had problems based on the fact that they were molested by men in their lives when they were growing up. Yeah. And he does a whole bunch of research into this. He talks to a lot of women about this. This is happening all over the place, and it's causing the symptoms that we now associate with
PTSD.
And specifically PTSD that comes from child sexual abuse. Yes. Now, he publishes his findings and he gives his speeches and he's going to write himself a book. And basically, he gets thrown out of polite society.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to hear it. They don't want to hear that rich people are people who are, again, rich enough to be able to afford therapy for their kids in turn of the century Vienna. So we're talking about the upper classes here. They don't want to hear that these people have been molesting their kids. Yeah. So what he does is, he says, oh, well, it's a fantasy. It is repressed sexuality. It is messed up adolescent sexuality that hasn't been directed right. And they create these fantasies about the authority figures in their lives, molesting them, the men in their lives, molesting them. And that is what it is. And that is what we call the Oedipal complex and the Electra complex. And he invents those as a way so polite society can accept the need to treat PTSD. Because you still need to treat the PTSD, but he does it in the worst possible way by telling them that, in a sense, it was their fault because it's a natural human fantasy, right?
Yep.
And of course, now we've abandoned all that because we know that kids get molested a lot.
I wish we'd abandoned all that.
Smart people have abandoned it.
Yeah.
But it has been largely abandoned because of the awareness that, kids are getting molested all the time and their parents are doing it a lot.
Or their family members.
Or their family members. There's uncles. There's close friends. Blah, 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 blah. Just watch the documentary about Larry Nassar on HBO if you want to know how awful this is.
Yeah.
It's really hard to watch, but if you don't believe me, just watch that documentary. But the point is, and here's the point I'm getting at. What happened in the Satanic Panic was that people were finding out about the sickening degree of child molestation that was going on in America. And American Bible Belt people could not accept the amount of child molestation that was going on around them as being an everyday crime. So what happened was all of these Bible Belt people said there has to be like some reason for this other than people are sick and want to molest kids and there's way more of them than you realize or are comfortable suspecting. And so the story they came up with was satanic child molesting rings. And it is every bit as much of a fiction as the Oedipus complex was. It is the exact same kind of fiction designed to cover up a horrible truth. And this is the key. What people conflate this and they don't understand. It's not that the molestation wasn't happening. It's that there were no devil-worshipping sex cults. There just weren't. That's something that the cops made up and the psychologists made up because they didn't want to accept the truth that people were raping their children. And people were raping their nieces and their nephews. And a guy frigging got into being a youth pastor or got into being a scout leader just so he could molest kids. They didn't want to accept that, so they came up with this crazy theory. And then you had this problem where you had psychologists who believe this going around saying, well, they must have been worshiping the devil. They molested you. So tell me more about the devil worship. Right?
I'm sitting here listening.
I mean, if there's a part I'm getting wrong, you're the expert on this. You're the one who taught me all about this. That's why I'm trying to do the speech, so I can prove to you that I was paying attention. And what happened was, the problem was, when people started attacking the recovered memories and saying, no, there really weren't all of these elaborate child molesting satanic rituals. There weren't people being impregnated with children so they would have the babies in secret and the babies were sacrificed to Satan. You know, when they found out that all of that was lies, they went and they said all the molestation was lies too. And that's the problem. And you are never going to see a greater example of that than this show's season 11 episode, or season 10 episode, Mr. Scratch.
We'll get there.
And because then we'll go that on is an episode, that is an episode that exists only to do the kind of covering work for child molesters that I've been talking about here. And the reason it's one of the most fascinating episodes ever is because the truth of what really happened, their really world child molestations, it was only the devil stuff that was a lie, is so obviously, like, that is so obviously true that the meta narrative of the episode can't help but admit that Mr. Scratch's dad obviously molested those kids. Even though the episode wants to say he didn't, the meta-narrative of the episode makes it clear that he did. And that is why Mr. Scratch is going to be one of the most fascinating episodes we've ever talked about. I'm predicting it now. So yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say is we have strong feelings about the recovered memory issue.
Well, no, I've always had it was just that stupid. And I remember Elizabeth. Oh God, what the hell was her last name? Anyway, I mean, there are all these different people I've met over the years.
Yeah.
Right. Or interacted with over the years. Geez, I could have become famous if I hadn't had my own issues, I'm sure. Except that I could never, but people don't want to hear. Well, no. What it is people don't want to hear what I have to say, really.
Exactly.
Deep down inside. I call it the sins of the fathers. Yeah. And anything, you will put any kind of spin on your theology, on your ethics, on your morals to exculpate the parents for the abuse that they have perpetrated on their children.
And for the monsters that their children have become.
Yeah. Well, and it's not even that. It's even if, like, there's a new documentary out, a little documentary. It's going to be at Sudbury Cinefest. And it's about one of the cases that occurred at one of the Roman Catholic schools. Ugh. Right. And so this boy, this one of the men who talks, and he had gone so many times, but what I mean to tell you, right, is that this was one of those cases where he complained to his father because it was this particular, he was the gym teacher and he was the guidance counselor and a whole bunch of other things, this priest. And so of course he told his parents, his father, went to the school board. He went to the priest and everything else that ran it. And of course, their line was, no, 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 he must have misinterpreted, blah, 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 Jesus blah, Christ. Right? Okay. But the kid never got molested again. Like, this guy stayed away from him. And then, of course,
he was smart enough to stay away once he'd been called on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Of course. You know, and that's, of course, as I say, the sins of the fathers. But his father, and then he said, and he was talking and he was going, and it never seemed to connect what I always talk about. And I talked about when we were doing the inside.
Yeah.
But is the difference for him, because as he said, well, you know, he never got married and never had children, I don't think, but
Jesus,
I don't think, but he said, I never had drug problems and I never had alcohol problems and all of this stuff. Or maybe he got married but didn't have children. Something along those lines. Right. But he said it didn't affect me the way it affected so many of these other guys, because he went to the police and the police said, I've got to have more than you.
Yeah.
And so he would talk to some of these other guys, and right, that he went to school with, and they would say they would come forward, but they wouldn't. Okay. Right. But eventually it did all come out. But
God.
Yeah. When the guy's dead now, of course.
Yeah, of course.
The priest, because he's that old, and countless mm-hmm. other victims that nobody knows about, I'm sure. But as he said, but he never connected the fact that his parents believed him and stood up for him and had it stop.
That's how you heal.
With why he never ended up drug addicted, why he never ended up, because so many of these guys, the problem is that their parents
believe the parents don't trust them.
No, the parents believe the priests rather than their own children.
Well, again, go watch that Larry Nassar documentary. Yeah,
it's the same thing, yes. It's
there is a whole story in there.
And it has nothing to do with religion.
Nope.
Nope.
No.
Total.
It's secular. That they will always take sides against children.
Yeah. You know, as I said, I mean, my story was always lucky, was always different, because at least, you know, if your parents
that's the thing. It's like the key thing there. If your parents believe you, if your parents take your side, then you can avoid so much of this simply because, like, otherwise, the people who were supposed to protect you
have thrown you to the wolves.
Not just thrown you to the wolf, actively taken the side of your abuser.
Yeah.
How do you come back from that?
Yeah, well, it's...
And the answer is, many people don't come back from that.
Or you do like my mother did, and you never, ever...
talk to your mother again.
Your mother again until, except the one time she had to.
Yeah. But that's the key part.
But that's
all right,
the
only
thing you can do. It's the only thing you can do. And here, of course, this child, had she said anything, wouldn't have been believed anyway.
Well, she wouldn't have been believed. She was a 6-year-old kid.
And she was in grief over her. And
she was in grief over her mother. No one would have listened to her at the time.
Yeah, and it would have seen soon when Dave Rossi didn't believe her either.
That's true.
The whole
Dave Rossi's first instinct is to not believe her.
Not only first instinct, he keeps it up.
It's true.
In that episode. And this is actually written by Jim Clemente.
Fascinating. Yeah. Well, honestly, Jim Clemente and the rest of the FBI have a lot to answer for. In the whole satanic panic thing, because they were the guys who went out there and said, no, none of it's real. It's all false memories, blah, blah, blah.
And
it's Jim Clemente and it's the rest of the guys.
You get that.
But they don't admit that the molestation was happening. It was just the satanic stuff that was fake. They act like the whole, it was all false accusations.
Yeah. And that's what you're getting in this episode.
And that's what we continuously get from the show. It is defensiveness on the part of Jim Clemente and other FBI agents who still refuse to accept. Because these guys, the crazy part is, and I mean, this is what we see over and over again, right? We see over and over again that these guys, who should be the best at understanding human minds, are less willing than anybody to admit they were wrong. Do you know that John Douglas still thinks that Guy Paul Morin killed that little girl?
Yeah, I know.
Still.
Yeah. DNA evidence has proven that...
Not only DNA evidence, it came out years later that the Guy Paul Morin left work, clocked out at work at 4 o'clock. The girl's family got home at 4:15. And it takes Guy Paul Morin 10 whole minutes to get home. Unless he found this little girl and she got off school at like 2:30. So either her killer attacked her in that hour and 45 minute window, or somehow Guy Paul Morin, in the 5 minutes between him getting home and them getting home, managed to do all of the abduction and disposal and get back to his house. because he was back at his house. And the cops, and this is true, the cops were sure Guy Paul Morin did it. And so they went to John Douglas and they said, did Guy Paul Morin do it? And John Douglas said, yes, Guy Paul Morin did it. And they're like, but we got to do something about this alibi, that he rock solid alibi he has. So they went to the parents and, no, the father was in jail, the mother and the son. And they said, are you sure you got home at 4:15? And they're like, yes, we are sure we got home at 4:15. And they're like, here's the thing. We know who did it, but he has an alibi then for then. Are you sure you got home at 4:15? And they said, maybe it was 5:15.
Yeah, I know. I know.
The cops badgered them into changing their story because they had a guy who wanted to be the killer. And years later, they find the body. They find, like, they find semen on her clothes, presumably by the killer, and John Douglas's response is, maybe it was semen from one of the many other guys who was sexually abusing this child.
I know.
That's his response.
Yeah, we know. We've read the book.
In addition to all those guys, he's the one who really did it. And he still thinks that to this day. And it's the same way Jim Clemente won't admit what he did wrong in the Satanic Panic.
Guess what? And I mean, did we ever discuss this? But I mean, and Jim Clemente is also a survivor of child sexual assault in a gym by a priest. I would assume it was a Roman Catholic. I think it was a Roman Catholic.
He's named Jim Clemente. He's Roman Catholic.
No. I think it was a community center. Well, it's the Derek Morgan
story.
Catholics,
obviously.
It's the Derek Morgan story, basically.
Yeah, except Derek Morgan's guy was just a coach, not a priest.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't. Well, Derek isn't Roman Catholic, right? He's a fundamentalist Protestant.
Yeah.
Although why he reacts to Roman Catholic priests is beyond me. Maybe he was raised Roman Catholic and we just don't know it. There are lots of African American Roman Catholics.
Oh, absolutely.
So
yeah, that's another interesting question. All right. So obviously, the fact that this episode touched on recovered memories and stuff like that, by the way, again, it's not a recovered memory. It's a flashback. It's only a recovered memory if a therapist helps you find it.
Yes. And
because you actually went looking for it. Yeah. She had a PTSD triggering event, which is a completely different thing than a recovered memory. I'm not saying the PTSD triggering events can't be misleading. Of course they can, but it's a different thing than a recovered memory.
Yes. All right. Yes.
So yeah, we have a lot to complain about in this episode is my point.
Yes. But, and of course, then there's the classic. Well, there's, if you are looking for, will they or will they not, will or will not this boy survive? Well, of course he's going to survive because we saw him.
No. It is close, though. Although, again, it's only that close because they didn't put surveillance on the frigging guy.
Yeah. And they could have. They could have.
They could have surveilled him. And they would have seen him go out to that shed and get the boy out of a thing and put him in a car and drive him to a job site. Like, there's no reason not to be surveilling this guy. You believe there's a kid on his property, but you're not looking at him. It's just insane. So yeah, bad work on their part this episode. And honestly, they could have just surveilled him and caught him going to get the kid and put a gun to the kid's head like they always do. But instead, they do this whole thing where they have to find him as he's burying the kid alive. Well, because the episode's called Foundation. Get it?
Yes.
Jesus.
Yes, we have to be consistent with our cutesy titles for our shows.
So frustrating. So, that's it for this week. If you're watching along with us, we'd love to give you your homework for next week's show. What are those episodes going to be, Doctor?
Episode 19, which is called Heathridge Manor.
Yay! Yeah. That's the next Matt Gubler episode.
Yep. And then 20, which is The Company.
Oh my God. I'm so excited to talk about The Company.
Yeah. Morgan's sister.
And episode 21?
Divining Rod.
That one? Oh, I remember. Okay. I was about to say, was that? And then I did remember which episode it was.
Yeah.
It's pretty ridiculous.
No. Don't. No spoilers. No spoilers.
No spoilers. Just in case. If people haven't watched these episodes yet, I won't do any spoilers, but I just remember what Divining Rod is, and oh my god. We'll get there. So yeah, if you'd like to, if you are going to watch it along with us, please, those are the episodes to catch up on. We hope that you have been watching Suspect Behavior this whole time in the Monday bonus episodes. It's either over now, or it's either ended this week or ends on this coming Monday. I haven't kept great track of that because we record these so far in advance. But we hope you took the time to watch Suspect Behavior. If not, seriously, go back and take a look at it. It is 100% absolutely worth your time.
Yep.
I can say that to a 100% degree of certainty that Criminal Minds Suspect Behavior is worth your time and attention. Just one more time, please watch it, because we're going to stop talking about it after we get out of season 7. It's only going to come up once every now and then. So, yeah, like, put in the effort, watch what this show could have been. Yep. We don't think you'll be disappointed. So I guess that's that. If you want to, if you'd like to reach out to us, you can find us at profilingcriminalminds @gmail.com. We would love to hear from you if you have any questions, if you have any comments, if you have any profiling related fiction that you think you should we should check out, that is where you can reach us. So we'll see you back here for next week, next Thursday, for episodes 719 through 721. That should be a blast. But until then, thanks for listening, and au revoir.
And have a good weekend.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.